Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
This is Dmitry Samarov from Chicago, Illinois, and I love listening to Vish Khanna's Creative Control because whether he's talking to a favorite musician or actor of mine or someone I've never heard of, it's as if he's introducing me to a new friend. And the way things are going, couldn't you use a new friend? Listen now.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Radwan Ghazi Mumne is a musical and visual artist, record producer, and audio engineer based in his adopted hometown of Montreal, Quebec. Originally from Lebanon, where his parents still call Beirut home, Mumne is a co-owner of the Hotel Tatango recording studio and one of its primary engineers. Since 2012, Mumne has been the driving force behind Jerusalem in My Heart, which is now a collaborative project with Montreal-based filmmaker Aaron Weisgerber that features contemporary Arabic and electronic music explorations interwoven with 16mm film projections and light-based deconstructions of space, exploring a relationship between music, visuals, sociocultural history, projections, and audience members. On October 8, 2021, Constellation Records released Kalak, the latest album by Jerusalem in My Heart, which is now also available in an elaborate box set version. We talk about that on this episode. Towards the end of that same year of 2021, Radwan and I had a lovely chat about this musical and immersive live project his experiences on tour of late, including being locked down in a European airport hotel when pandemic lockdowns first began in March of 2020, why his family fled Beirut when he was just 15 years old, and the culture shock they all endured upon first arriving in Montreal, how he got into music via bands like Sonic Youth, Misfits, and Suicidal Tendencies, his penchant for wearing very dark sunglasses all of the time, his work at the Hotel Tatango, how the catastrophic 2020 explosion in Beirut impacted his family, and why Lebanon is a hopelessly failed state, the story behind the music and visual imagery of Kalak, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network, with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, with additional support from Blackbird Music, a well-stocked record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and very friendly staff who will happily help you with all your needs. You can learn more about them at blackbird.ca. Plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is the 661st episode of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Radwan Ghazi Mumne with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Radwan. How are you?
I'm doing great, Vish. How are you?
I'm well. It's nice to chat with you again. It's been, I think, 8 years or something since we officially spoke on the record. Does that suit your recollection?
I have no recollection of anything ever. So you could say 8, you could say 18. I would be just agreeing with you. So I'm just going to agree with you.
Well, it's nice. I missed you. I gather you didn't even miss me, but I missed you.
No, not true. Not true. I swear not true. I actually was listening to your interview with Sofa. I was hanging out with Ian last night. He came over socially distanced, and I was telling him, he was like, I don't think anyone listened to that. I was like, shockingly, I found an hour and a half of my time to sit there and listen to it while I was like cleaning up my studio. And I was like, oh, it's just so nice to hear Ian, the band member, versus Ian, the label, you know, runner person. But yeah, no, definitely. And I was listening, I was like, oh, well, I wonder if I'm going to do one of these. And lo and behold, here we are.
Well, first of all, thank you for listening. Second of all, I love that Ian was like, I don't think anybody listened to that. Ian, if you're listening, or Radwan, if you see Ian, tell him it was actually one of the more popular episodes of that month, and I think it did circulate quite a bit. So tell him he's wrong. People care about Sofa, and he's wrong. Just tell him, just in general, when you see Ian,
He knows he's wrong.
Just tell him he's wrong about stuff. He's generally wrong. Just be like, Ian, once again, you're wrong.
12 years I've been trying to tell him he's always wrong. Doesn't seem to understand that guy.
Yeah, I hope you enjoyed that. That was quite a memory jog for all of those fellows, I imagine. But I felt like it went really fluidly. It seemed to work.
It was great. You know, what's really interesting is Sofa was one of the very first handful of shows that I saw when I moved to Montreal. Strangely, I saw like their release of their 7-inch.
Oh, wow.
Because I was roommates with John Asensio for like a minute, who ran a label that put out that 7-inch. It was Constellation, and I can't remember the name of the label. John played in a band called Starbean, and they had a record label, and the Sofa 7-inch was a split release between Constellation and John's label.
Right. That's right.
And I, as a friend, went to the show, and I was like, wow. This is, it's just, when I told Ian that years ago, he was like, what? You were there? I was like, how weird is that?
That is amazing. Now you are, I usually ask people where in the world they are. You are in Montreal as we're speaking, right?
I am in Montreal. I just came back from a month-long trip to Europe, which shockingly happened and was uninterrupted. But yeah, I was in Europe and I've been back for a few weeks, a couple of weeks now. And yeah, just here for this little period. Very, very busy in the studio, and actually going to be taking off again in March, again for a month.
Now, were you in Europe for music touring reasons or just for a trip?
Yeah, I had a 1 week residency with an Iranian photographer. Her name is Masheed Muhajirin. She's an incredible photographer, and we were working on a performance. We'd never met. We don't know each other. We just had some agents who decided that it would be a good idea for us to work together. And yeah, so we had a 1 week residency in Ghent, Belgium, at, I don't know if it was a very famous venue called Vereit. Mm-hmm. And I was there for a week. And then after that, Aaron Weisgerber, my partner in Jerusalem in my heart, flew into Europe and she met me there. And we did our 3 week tour, European tour. So we did that 3 weeks of playing shows. And then we came back to Montreal.
Well, you expressed some surprise that the trip happened in the first place. Were there people there? Was it a situation where the tension because of the pandemic was present for you all, or was it fairly normal?
It was as if there was nothing, to be honest. That was the big shocker, was that how little people cared. Mm. It was just very, very, very relaxed on every level. So it was a bit weird for sure. But also very nice that we got to do it, because last time we were on the road was, this is crazy also, it was March 2020. We were on tour when, you know, the world came to a grinding halt. We were in Spain when we had to just pack up our gear and just run to the airport because nobody knew anything and everything was falling apart. And the news we were getting was just so insane and distorted. And everybody was just projecting as to what the hell was about to happen. So yeah, we were doing a month long tour with Lucrezia Adult, and we were like not even six shows into something like, 28 shows. And we were headed from Spain towards Northern Italy, the epicenter of it all back then. And yeah, just the news was crazy. And then, of course, I think we were one of the very last bands, like North American bands, on tour at that point when we came. But we were stuck in Amsterdam airport for about 5 days before we could get a flight because everything just got canceled. And we were just in touch every day with our travel agent until she got us on a flight back home. And we landed here. And yeah, that was March 16, I think, is when we landed in Montreal.
You were stuck in an airport for 5 days, you say? Like you couldn't leave the airport? You couldn't get a hotel or something?
Airport hotel. You couldn't be in the airport. Nobody was allowed in the airport unless you were going from like the main front door to your gate.
Oh, wow.
Like they boarded up every chair. There was nowhere to sit on. Anything that a human could sit on was taped up. So, and they closed everything. And in the hotel, they closed the restaurant, of course, and the vending machines. And the only thing that we could eat was from this, like, you know, convenience store that they left open at the airport, and we would just take the free shuttle bus from the hotel, the Ibis, budget Ibis, to the airport, grab like a baguette, hummus, bottle of wine, go back to the hotel, eat it each in our own room, because we couldn't leave our rooms. You could only leave a room to leave the hotel. It was insane. It was just such a weird time, but it was kind of so that was the last time we toured. So then almost 2 years later, we go back to Europe and I'm like, oh my God, I wonder if this is going to happen again. And yeah, you know, we had some scares. We had a couple of three countries we were in went into lockdown like immediately after we played there. Immediately. Mm. So it was a bit intense. But, you know, in the moment, nothing felt weird. Nothing at all felt
so weird. So yeah, I want to touch upon that for a second. You say nothing felt weird. People were treating everything as though it was normal life.
Yeah.
Does that give you any perspective on how we, when you're back here in North America, does it give you any perspective as to how we're dealing with it or reacting to it? Does it seem like there, does Europe seem too cavalier about it, or do we seem to be over worrying? Do you have any take on that?
I do. I mean, it's a bit of both for sure. I don't think they're like cavalier about it. I think they're more like, this is just going to happen and it is what it is. And people just continued living their life, I feel. And the weird thing was definitely the realization that how quote unquote good we were here about following the rules. We were there and it was weird if you had not had COVID. Whereas for us, I was telling everybody we'd met, I was like, I can count on one hand the amount of people I know who had COVID. Mm-hmm. So the difference, and people were like, that's really weird that you didn't have COVID. And I was like, that is just so weird. Like, it was so everybody we met had COVID at one point. And I was like, oh, that's really weird. Okay. That's really, really weird.
Yeah.
But funnily enough, now in this very moment, COVID is just like on my door, at least. It's like my sister has it and a bunch of my friends have it. And yeah, it's just crazy. It's just this. It's never been that close. I feel it's like just a matter of when, not if, at this point. Before it was like I didn't think I was going to get it, and just was like we're just respecting the rules for the most part. You know, we're not being super cautious, but we're not being reckless by any stretch of the imagination. And nobody was getting it. And now doing the same thing, and yet everybody I know has it, and everybody I know also has kids. And you know, with kids, that's just that's like the big X factor there, the kids.
Yeah, that's why I'm we are staying as locked down as we are. It's mostly for the children and our children in particular, but all of them. Yeah, you're right. I feel like it's I still think you don't want to get it in any shape because it seems to affect people in different ways with different severity. But at the same time, I think you're right. We're coming closer to the idea that everyone will get some iteration of it. And hopefully if you're vaccinated, your body can handle it. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It is just annoying. We're at a state now where almost 2 years in and our governments are just, you know, just still are not learning lessons. And it's just blowing my mind. I mean, I don't know. I'm no scientist, of course, and I'm no politician, but it feels that like the approach is still prevention, which is not going to happen, as opposed to protecting those people who need to be protected. I don't know. I think if all the resources were focused on that, I feel like we'd be maybe somewhere a little bit more sane. Because right now, whatever's happening is not making people sane because people are insane. Everybody is insane.
Yeah.
Like just how polarized people are, how politicized this whole thing has gotten. It's just out of control. And I think whatever measures are happening, we are the 30th today. I think today at 4 p.m., the curfew, I think there will be a New Year's Eve curfew in effect as of today. Mm-hmm. So I don't think people will be able to go out on New Year's Eve. So I don't know. It's just like all of it just seems like provocative. It's just provoking citizens more than anything. In the beginning I was like, yeah, we have to do it. This is good. This is great. But now, you know, fourth wave, fifth wave, still we're doing the same thing. You're like, how is it 2 years in and people still have not learned how to deal with this in a way that's manageable in any shape or form?
I agree with you on the leadership level completely. But I also will give them a slight pass because the thing is mutating and we thought we were doing everything. Well, sorry, not all government. I'm calling you from Alberta, where the leadership has not dealt with this consistently properly the whole time. But I mean, the thing also, we all thought we were at least in the middle of a tunnel and could see the light. And now the thing was like, you know what? I'm going to become different and mutate.
Add another kilometer to this tunnel.
Yeah. So like I hear what you're saying and I agree, but I also think like, the reality is this thing is going to probably, because the vaccination rates are not, it's not a universally mandated situation. It's not an equitable situation where all nations are being vaccinated. So the thing,
that's what I mean. The politics of it are what the problem is. Also simple things like why are rapid tests not available to us to buy from a pharmacy like they are in Europe? Like when we were in Europe on tour, we bought a box of 20 rapid tests and we're just doing tests before going to a show. Before we arrived at soundcheck, we do a check, just preventative. You're like, I didn't want it on my shoulders that I'm positive, asymptomatic, I show up to a venue and, you know, out of this one show, you know, 50 people walk out with COVID. So Aaron and I were doing the rapid test and it was just as simple as walking to a pharmacy. I'd like a box of rapid tests. Here you are, €2.50 per test. You're like, okay. And here in Quebec, it's like people, did you see that online? People are selling those for $500 a test.
Yeah, and they're being fined $100,000 if they get caught or something. Is that right?
But all that's what I mean. It's just like, it's like a fucking snake eating itself. It's like, there's a way to prevent all of this, right? Like, which is just make these things accessible to people. These things help. These things don't not help, you know? It's like, why the failure is like, why don't we give people tools to like administer these tests so they can be preventative? Like in Europe, a lot of people were respecting, people weren't going over to dinners unless their tests were negative. And just things that were, I was like, why are these rare here? Why is it a rarity? Why do we have to wait 3 hours to get a PCR in Quebec? It's like, just makes no sense. We're in the middle of winter. Like, how is that logical to stand outside for 3 hours to get a PCR test?
Yeah,
I don't want to get a PCR test, so I have to stand 3 hours. It's like, I don't know. It's just, I feel like all the money they're also pouring into policing people and into like finding people and all these things. But that's just my socialist brain, just being like, there's just different ways of doing it. But I agree with you. It's a mutating thing. It's a disaster. It's not an easy thing to handle at all. But, you know, there's bottom lines for everybody. I get it. So it is what it is.
Yeah, but the trouble, the thing that's creating despondence and I think resignation with everything is that for all the good news, there's bad news. Like you mentioned the rapid tests, and we got our rapid tests, luckily, and a bunch of, there were only at the time that we got them like 500,000 tests available for a population of 4 million people in this province. And so yeah, that's bad. But then, yeah, and but we've done them a couple of times, and luckily we are fine so far. But but then you start to read stories about people saying, well, I didn't get a negative result until I tried. It was my fourth test. Like, I was symptomatic, and the test told me three times I was fine, but on the fourth one it said I was positive. So then, like, every good, you're like, yeah, rapid test. This seems to happen with the information about what we're going through. There's initially good news.
Yeah,
vaccines work. It's going to work. We're going to be we're going to be good. Rapid tests work.
Yeah.
It's going to be good. And then there's always just like the, it's just, I understand. It's very hard. It's just a roller coaster ride. So anyway, you and I are not going to solve this issue today, but I appreciate that you had these experiences in Europe, and you're safe and you're going to head back, you say, to Europe at some point soon in the new year?
Well, I mean, we're supposed to head back in March for, I'm going for 1 week to produce an artist's album in Belgium. Again, I always do these things. I always like bookend my trips. Well, bookend. I was like, before the tour starts or after a tour starts, I always have take care of a project, because then it's just, I'm there. It's easier. You know, it's one flight as opposed to like taking two flights to do something. So I will be going a week before the tour starts, actually 9 days before the tour starts. I have a recording session with an artist. I'm producing her album. And after that, we do our 3 week tour again. So yeah, it's the same thing again.
I see.
The spring version of the fall thing we just did.
Well, I appreciate you mentioning this, because I want to catch people up who are listening just with your general life world, because I alluded to the fact that we last spoke, I believe it was 2013, which I think coincided with perhaps the first Jerusalem in My Heart record. Is that fair? Is that about right? 2013 or so?
Wow. I have, you know, I really don't mean to sound silly. I have no idea. I am so like, I got in trouble.
Don't worry about it.
I got in trouble. I just got to tell you this. I got in trouble a year and a half ago when we went to Aruba to visit my partner's family. They live there. And we had to fly through the States. And a border cop, we were the kids, he asked me, he was like, the American border cop, he was like, are these your children? And I was like, of course they are. And he's like, what are their birth dates? And I totally froze. And I couldn't tell him the birthdays. I just guessed two dates. And of course they were wrong. And the guy was like, oh my God, I can't believe you just told me the wrong birth dates of your kids. And I was like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. And yeah, my partner was like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
You like, have some memory issues is what you're saying. You have some memory issues, or is it date specific? You just don't remember years and dates? Is that what's going on?
It's dates. It's really dates. It's dates. I absolutely cannot retain dates.
Okay. Well, I don't have the research in front of me, but I believe, I'm just going to speculate that Jerusalem in My Heart began, would you guess it's about 10 years old or so as we're speaking? Is that right?
Well,
the band, the project?
There was 3 records between every record, 4 records, 10, 12 years ago.
Okay. So I want to catch people up on a couple of things. Number one, I know you, before Jerusalem in My Heart, I knew you as one of the engineers. Are you a co-owner of the Hotel Tatango studio?
Yeah, I own it with 3 other fellows.
Right. Okay. So I know you as that type of person, producer, engineer, studio owner, and I know you from Jerusalem in My Heart, but there are people listening who might not know all of these things. So I want to get a little biographical before we talk about this latest record, if that's okay with you. So let's begin, because I think it predates Jerusalem in My Heart. How did you get into engineering, and how did you end up working with the people that you worked with to start the Hotel Tatango? Can you talk a little bit about those things?
Sure. I've been doing this for a very long time. It's kind of like the only job I've ever done, actually. I, you know, like most musicians who are recording engineers, started out with like, you know, simple cassette 4-track recorder, like the band I played in, and, you know, wanted to record it and went to school for it after I realized that I really liked it. And yeah, I've been working in studios forever, and so long ago at this point, maybe 19, 18, 20 years ago, let's just say, met the Silverman Zion people and was doing live sound for them and some recording in the studio and on tour with them. And Yeah, from there, there were Hotel Tatango already existed in a rented loft that was across the street from where we are now. And there was the three of them. It was Ephraim Menick, Terry Amar, and Howard Billerman. And they were like, you know, we talked about, I started engineering everything I did there. And very quickly, you know, was bringing in a lot of work to the studio. And yeah, and then we just had a conversation about, like, we're thinking of buying a place. Do you want to come in with us? And I was like, yeah, great, super. And we, the pool of people who was looking for a place was Constellation Records, Hotel Tutango, and Grey Market Mastering. So the three entities together, we bought the building that we are in now, which we bought, I believe, 16 years ago, mm-hmm. 17 mm-hmm. years ago.
Yeah.
And yeah, and then we opened the studio, and Howard and I are more the sort of, you know, career engineers, you know, people who do this as a job. And Ephraim and Terry are more musicians mm-hmm. for a career, and they engineer on the side. So yeah, and that's like, that works out perfectly, like in terms of scheduling and in terms of the type of projects that come in and come out of the studio. And yeah, I've just been doing that for quite a long time.
Yeah.
Quite a long time.
Yeah.
And I engineer actually quite a bit of Constellation's catalog, totally by coincidence. But I just by virtue of being friend, I totally am serious, just by virtue of being friends with these artists. And yeah, that's how that has become that.
Okay, I want to interject for one moment, because yeah. when we were talking earlier about you seeing that first sofa show,
yeah.
you had suggested that was one of the first things you saw after moving to Montreal. Where did you move to Montreal from?
I was born in Lebanon in 75, in Beirut, the year the Civil War started. And my father, we think was in a little bit of kind of hot water with somebody, something. I don't know. I think just youth and silliness. I think. We don't know. He doesn't like to talk about it. But we basically had to get the hell out of there ASAP. And he went to the first country that gave him, not asylum, because at that point it wasn't really that. It was more like the first country that gave him a visa. So, which was Oman, which there was no reason for us to be there other than we had an uncle who was there who was going to like help us settle down yeah. there. So we moved to the Sultanate of Oman, and I lived there from, yeah, the ages of basically 0 to 15. And at 15 years old, we moved to Canada, to Montreal.
I see.
My parents only lasted 5-6 years. My parents are Arabs that don't speak English or French. You know, they're really Lebanese, and they just did not at all. It just did not work out for them here at all. They felt super isolated, super just uncomfortable, especially my mom. She really, really, really disliked it here. The cold weather, they're just Mediterranean Arabs, you know? So yeah, after in 2000, they moved back to Lebanon, and I stayed. I, you know, was playing music, was touring with my bands, and wanted to record, become an engineer, and really wanted to, you know, have this as a career.
I see. So you're 25 years old. You're an adult. You can stay in Montreal if your parents head back. And that's fascinating. I assumed that you would have all relocated because of the Civil War. But you're yeah. saying it was more because of your father's personal circumstances.
No, sorry. It was because of the Civil War. Excuse me. It was because of the Civil War. And all of a sudden, the neighborhood we are from, where I was born, and my parents lived with my grandparents, it's just very, 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 it was like a hotspot for problems. It was just an insane, two very, very differing sects who were like sharing in a very, very, very dense part. And things got hot very quickly between militias and stuff. So I only say he was in trouble because he was kind of friends with a lot of these people. And, you know, it was just like guilty by association thing. And I think we had to go because of the Civil War.
I see. Were you in Beirut or like a neighboring part of Beirut?
The heart of Beirut, the heart of the western part of Beirut. Basically a neighborhood that is split, one side of the street pretty much is like Sunni and the other side Shia. And I come from a rare mix of my mother is Shia and my father's Sunni.
Wow.
So there's, yeah, wow. yeah. So it's, there's families don't talk, you know, it's very, very not, there's no love lost between the two families. And yeah, we're kind of a rare breed, me and my siblings.
I see. So that's fascinating in itself. Okay.
Of course.
All right. So you're 25 years old, you're in Montreal. And you mentioned that you were, I think you suggested you were kind of a musician turned engineer. What was your primary, what are your primary instruments as a musician?
Well, I have no musical formal education at all. So when we moved to Canada, it was a very difficult move. I really for my parents, for us, I don't know, culture shock would be an understatement. Like to say it, we were just an utter culture shock. And I was in high school here, and it was very difficult for me because I really was not accepted at all by the kids in the school. It was an all-boys school, so it was very difficult. My father was really scared about his kids kind of going down the wrong path. We're in Canada, the land of crime and drugs, and everybody's a drug addict here, and everyone's a homosexual, and all these fucking, these craziness that they had in their fucking head.
Right.
Complete ignorance, because they have just no connection to anything here. They had no friends here. They had no Canadian friends. They never had Canadian friends. They never made a Canadian friend. It was really crazy.
Huh.
And, they're also Arabs who don't speak French, which in Lebanon, that is something that there's a classism there to the French speaking portion of the society versus the non-French speaking portion of society. So yeah, it was very complicated for them. I really I feel so bad for them because they had it so rough, so rough. And so I played music and I just met after 2 years of being in school, just met these three other weirdo guys. And we all kind of liked a bit of the same music. I was into kind of heavy metal and a bit of punk, but I didn't even know what punk was. I just I remember it was a Misfits cassette that I bought at the airport, actually, just because there was a big skull on the cover. I was like, oh my God, this sounds great. This looks like it sounds great. And of course, I was utterly shocked when I listened to it. I was like, wait, this doesn't sound like heavy metal. This is crazy. I love this, but what the hell is this? And, and I was into bands like Suicidal Tendencies, things that were just kind of crossover that thrash punk, but also kind of had metal elements to it, because that's all we knew. And I was in Oman, I was into heavy metal. Yeah. And it was the most rebellious music you could listen to. So that's what I liked. And yeah, so I met one person in particular who strangely I still am in touch with, and actually I'm recording his band in January. It's amazing. He's a very important person in my life. I love him dearly, 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 even though we're so different. We're so, so, so different. He is my very first Canadian friend. So I love him to bits. And he's still playing music. He has not changed, which is so endearing, because I feel like I have not changed either. I'm still doing the same thing I did when I met him, which is be a degenerate and play music and kind of somehow get by.
Did you want to name them?
Yeah, of course. Christopher Snellgrove. Very, 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 very dear friend. He plays in a band called, his project, which is a solo project sometimes a band, sometimes solo, called The Last Mile. And it's beautiful, kind of folky punk music that he makes. Chris, if you're listening, I hope I'm not doing you a disservice by saying these things, but he is just very talented, has a real sense for harmony, melody, and just very honest, sincere, from the heart music. Oh, nice. which is beautiful. The aesthetics of it are just far from what my world is, but that is literally that's the beauty of the job that I do, is that you take these things that are just not you and you make them you. How do I make this me? How do I apply these skills to this person's ideas? What's in this person's head, and how do I make that into a record?
Right.
So I'm very looking forward to that. Anyway, so he actually we was like, let's play music. There's this high school talent show. Do you want to do this with us? And I was like, yeah, I want to do this. So we started a band. We called it Native Curses. And none of us played any instruments, and he called up a friend of his, and we learned how to play Sonic Youth's Dirty Boots.
Oh,
and that
nice.
Was the first piece of music I ever learned how to play.
That song's got the the octave chord in it, doesn't it? Slide up and down the neck with it.
Yeah.
That's one of the first songs I learned to play, and it's got the maybe
hilarious.
I'm saying the wrong thing. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, of course. No, I totally know what you mean. This friend, his name was Kieran McNamara, and he came. He was, again, he was from another school, but he was this really odd character, just completely wacky person. I was just like, wow, the world is so weird. I'd never met anybody this weird, weirdos like that. And each one of us was fighting as to which instrument they wanted to play, because none of us played anything. So we just got to pick. And this Kieran fellow who came and just taught us how to would put tape. He was like the talent. He was so talented. He would put tape on the guitar. He's like, put your finger here, then put your finger here, put your finger here. And then drummer's like, you hit this, then you hit that, then you hit this, then you hit that. And we did the high school talent show, and they turned off the electricity on stage while we were playing. We were so obnoxiously loud and terrible. And I mean, it's just like, yeah, it's like so romantic in a way, but I love it. I mean, I love that that was, and from there you're like, yeah, that's what I want to do. Yeah, that's exactly that feeling of like, they pulled the plug. They just turned off the electricity, literally pulled the plug on us. I was like, yeah, this is going to be with me for a long time in my life. And yeah, here we are. I'm 46 and still kind of trying to get the plug not pulled on me.
So the anti-authority aspects of art and music and culture appeal to you. You have that within you, this notion.
I'm very much, I mean, I don't know if you get that from what I do, but it's very much my identity, I have to say. It's very, very,
well, absolutely,
very much.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I will tell you that before we met, I would go to Montreal on occasion from when I lived in Ontario, and I would go to shows at Sala Rosa, or I don't know that I saw you at Casa, but I would see you running around. I have a memory of you running around at Sala Rosa doing
sound.
And
yeah,
you were distinctive because it was a dark bar, but you often, I don't know if you still do this, but you often wore sunglasses, dark sunglasses. Is that something you still do?
They're actually my optical prescription glasses. Yeah, I do. That's a tribute to my dad, I have to say. My father, we grew up with my father wearing his sunglasses that were his optical glasses. Do you say that, optical glasses? What's the term for glasses? Like,
prescription
glasses.
Right.
Sure. Sorry, prescription glasses.
Prescription, right. Yeah.
My father had very, very severe, he was severely myopic, and like so severe. He was like one of those people what, like in cartoons you see when they wear glasses, people's eyes are like little dots. Like, mm-hmm. It just shrinks their eyes to dots. And he was so ashamed of that. He was so embarrassed by how he looked that he would wear shades all the time. And growing up, I thought, I always was so into that. I was like, my father looked so great. I think he looked so beautiful in these glasses. And when I was very young, I was like, I'm going to get glasses like that when I grow up. And then my dad did an operation, fixed his eyesight to a certain degree, and he started wearing normal prescription glasses. And I was just like, yeah, like, I don't know, fucking 20 years ago, I was like, I'm going to do this. And I've been doing that since then. I still do. So, and now it's I can't wear regular glasses.
If you're in a darkened bar and you've got the mixing console and the band, is it difficult to see wearing sunglasses?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Do you have a special wattage for your board light so that you can?
No, I don't. No? Okay. I actually also, parallel to that, I have insane light sensitivity. It's insane. Like, I just, like, I can't see.
Because you wear sunglasses all the time, and when you take them off, your eyes are like, what the fuck is this?
When I'm in a restaurant and there's like a candle at the table, like, I put it out. Light like that hurts my eyes. Driving at night hurts my eyes.
Yeah.
It just, light really hurts my eyes, actually. Well, even though I love being in the sun so much.
I'm not a doctor or an optician or an optometrist. I don't know what the right word is. I think optometrist. But I imagine wearing sunglasses almost 24/7 is going to affect your eyesight. That's all I'm saying.
I'm 46. I feel it's okay.
Well, what are you going to do? Our eyes go. It's fine. Anyway, my point here is, thank you for that background about how you got into playing music and then your engineering stuff. I did want to touch upon one thing, though. Your parents basically, they didn't have a sense of belonging while they were in Montreal.
No.
Are you aware now, or were they aware even then, of any kind of burgeoning Lebanese community in the city? I gather they weren't able to meet with such people and feel a sense of belonging. Mm. But did it exist back then at that point?
Definitely did. Very much so. Yeah, Lebanese community in Montreal is very old. Not as old as, like, say, you know, Greek and Italian and, you know, others. But Lebanese, yeah, it's very, very strong because of the Catholic connection, right?
Right.
Because of a lot of Lebanese Catholics and Maronites moved to Montreal. And there's a couple of churches here that are quite important in the political spectrum for Lebanese people here. Because that's just how we roll as Lebanese. And yeah, so he was very aware of that. But my parents, you know, back in the time, I don't think we saw it that way or we understood it that way. But now, obviously, many years later, I understand the trauma that they were, like, you know, trying to cope with. They're also people that do not acknowledge that they are traumatized people, but they very much are. They are textbook traumatized people dealing with trauma, dealing with PTSD, but they just don't see it that way. They're just survivors. They're just people that, like, shut up, stop complaining. You're lucky that you are alive. That's the type of people that they are.
Well, I don't mean to paint with such a broad brush, but I assume if you live in a place like Beirut, which can be extremely volatile. I assume you develop a sort of sense of, we made it another day and we have to value and, you know, count our blessings in that regard. But absolutely. But I do think like this is when I, you know, my parents, when I grew up, they would be like, just randomly at the dinner table, you know, I'd say, can you pass the pepper? And they'd say, yes, here's the pepper. By the way, India is the best country in the world. And I would say, what?
That's my parents too.
What are you talking about? Well, and they'd say, India is just a reminder, a daily reminder.
Just a reminder.
That even though we're in Canada, India is the best. And then I, as I got older and would question their whatever, if they were like, you have to do this for religious reasons, I'd start to say why. And they had no real solid answers. But when I asked about India being the best, I finally piped up and said, if India is the best, why did you move to Canada? And they said, better standard of life. And I was like, how can it be the best place to live if you move to another place? So I wonder also with your, like your parents fled for, obviously there was a civil war. They moved back, but they must, and I don't, I wanted to ask this at some point. I don't know how they were personally impacted by the explosion in 2020, the port explosion. But anyway, we can talk about that in a second. But they must realize and recognize that they live in a very volatile place. Is there any part of you that's like, can you just come back? Why don't you come back to Canada? Like, this is too much. I worry about you. Do you have... Sorry, there's a mix of questions in there, but...
No, all of them. I'm following you. I'm totally following you. Because
do you have that concern as a son? Like, why don't you just leave? I know... I'm sure they have a social network there, if you will, but is it worth it? Like, it seems so volatile. Am I wrong about that?
You are, I mean, it. You can't say anything other than it is so volatile. Lebanon is, and are we allowed to swear?
Yes, of course.
Lebanon is just, everybody living in Lebanon is like up to their necks in shit. Like it is awful. It is awful to think of a country that has no functioning government, a government that is just a bunch of like petty mafiosos, like just petty mobsters, like not even professional mobsters, just kind of hacks. Who run the government. It's just a bunch of clans in the government where there's no electricity. I think we're at like 2 hours a day of electricity right now. That's what it's at. I mean, it changes from... No, Vish, you don't understand. Like, since my birth, there's never been 24-hour electricity in Lebanon. Do you understand that? Like, I'm 46. Lebanon has never seen 24 fucking hours of electricity. We don't have drinking water. Like, you buy drinking water. To drink water that won't kill you, you have to buy it. A truck has to come, it has to dump it, and you have to, that, and even that is like, they just, it's cheated all the time. It's just a very dysfunctional country. It's a country that's just, there's just no fixing it. At this point, it's fair to say that, it's scientific to say that there's no fixing it. It's just never going to be fixed. So volatile, I mean, what, we don't have any consensus in the country too. We have no idea how many Lebanese are in Lebanon because they refuse to do a proper consensus because of how politicized the consensus would be. We think there's maybe 3 million, 4 million Lebanese. There's maybe 1.5 million Palestinians. There's, at this point, who knows how many Syrians? Estimate is around 2-3 million Syrians. We don't even know. It's just such a shit show on every fucking level. So yeah, is it volatile? Yeah, of course it's volatile. Is it dangerous? Of course it's dangerous. You know, like nobody talks about COVID there. Like Corona, like COVID does not exist in Lebanon because it is literally the least of people's worries. Like the least. The least. It's like, it's hilarious how they look at us and they're like, ha ha ha, look at all you worried about COVID.
They don't even know what they've got there. Yeah. So again, back to my question. Like, how often do you get to talk to your parents and how often do you get to visit? I mean, COVID notwithstanding,
And COVID notwithstanding, 2 to 3 times a year I'm there. Of course, I'm there all the time. I have such a big community of like this family and then there's friends who are like bigger than family for me. And just yesterday, my partner and I, we were like, she was saying that she feels like we've lost some family because of the 2 years of not seeing them. She's like, she just feels so alienated. I mean, she is, I think it's actually somebody you know. She is somebody you know. Do you know Alexi Perry Cox?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, vaguely. We've met. I don't know Alexi super well, but we've met for sure. Yeah.
Oh, so she is my partner in life and the mother of our children.
Nice.
I agree.
So she's missing your visits to Lebanon.
Visits.
Are your parents back in Beirut?
They are there in Beirut. She actually lived there for a bit while I was had all this crazy travel. And no, she has actually, she knows more people than me there. She has like a whole community there and she speaks Arabic. She learned Arabic and she's very, very much, you know, has become Lebanese. She's like so tight with like my family. She talks to my parents more than I do. Like, it's crazy. It's like she's very, so for her, it's like also become, been very, very hard to deal with all of this. But anyhow, my parents came here. They came here, a year and a bit ago, upon my insistence, after a couple months after the explosion. They came in October of 2020. I was freaking out. I was like, this is just too much. You got to get on a plane. You got to come to Canada. You got to be here for 2-3 months. You just need a change of scenery just for a bit. Like, this is insane. I can't, like, this is really starting. Like, you got to think about me now. I'm going to be selfish here. It's like, think of me. Just come here for fuck's sake. And they did. They were great. They came here with my sister. My sister, who was very severely affected by the explosion, her office was gone, just blew up. She was right sort of, she's in the neighborhood where the explosion happened.
Good Lord.
Her, she was in her office. Her office just fucking, every fucking thing just blew.
She was at work during the explosion. Is she was that at work
during the explosion. Yeah, of course.
Oh my God. Was she unscathed though? Physically?
I mean, she was lucky that like Beirut is so dense that she was just like, she got away with like shrapnel cuts and glass flying across the room into her body. And so she was cut up and one of her employees was much more severely hurt. And her dog too was pretty fucked up. And you know, she was just like, fuck it. That's it. This is it. This is the straw. That's it. I'm out. I'm done. So she packed her shit up and moved here.
Oh, she moved there. That's great. I mean, sorry, I'm not one for fleeing places, although I just did this in a sense. I moved because I wasn't happy with our situation, even in Ontario. But yeah, no, that's obviously pales in comparison to what is going on there. And that explosion obviously was one of the scariest things I've ever seen. It's one of the greatest, I guess, what, artificial explosions in the history of the world. It was the magnitude of like a 3.3 earthquake or something. Like, it was just bizarre. And it was all just government idiocy, right? They'd stored this, what was it, ammonium nitrate or something like that? They just stored
ammonium nitrate,
and then left it unregulated, and it just, a fire broke out. And then, like, this explosion happened. It destroyed. And Beirut, by the way, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, it's one of the oldest cities in civilization, and it has all this, like, remarkable architecture, and, you know, even that gets the government. Cronyism and corruption has led to the leveling of ancient structures.
Say there's no hope.
Yeah, it's really hopeless. No. You're right. Okay, I hear what you're saying.
It's really hopeless on that level. Yes, of course. No, it's the foreign hand, the intervening foreign hand, will forever be present.
Right.
So that means that no matter what happens, many, many powers that are closer to you and me here would never allow for things to be in a way that could function for Lebanese. And full stop. We don't need to go into that more than that. That's all we need to say about that.
But, so your parents were here for, you said, for a few months. So does that imply
2.5
they
months.
Went back?
Yeah. They came here for 2.5 months. You know, it's like, and they were so excited. My mom had not set foot in Canada since 2000, since she left. When we returned, I flew with them. I had an insane amount of work, but I took a 3-day break to fly to Lebanon and fly back here just to drop them off. So my mother at the airport was like, I'll see you in 20 years, Canada. In another 20 years.
so there's something there. Is it simply that they're hardened and resolute, or is there something else? From your perspective, are they oblivious
to
how...
There is something else. No, I think there's something romantic about it. So we get to Lebanon, you know, and of course to Beirut. My father, we go up to the house, and my parents now live just outside the city in what, back then when they got their house in 2000 or 2005 or whatever it was. It was a kind of a suburb, very chill. They really wanted to be away from the craziness of Beirut. Now, funnily enough, has become just absolute disaster place where they live, and it's become very, very, very dangerous where they live. It's turned into a very very sketchy neighborhood, which is so funny. We were in the car the next day, and we were driving around a neighborhood. My dad had, again, his like things to do, and we were driving, and my father said something to me. He was just like, we're driving, and he was like, look around you. He's like, you see that garbage over there? It's like, yeah. He's like, you see that tire that's like just in the grass over there. You know, you see that like rusty car, you see that, you know, that guy over there, he's a thief and he has to stop. And he just kept pointing to everything negative. I was like, yeah. He's like, despite all that, this remains the best country on the planet. And I was like, says wow. It all. Said yeah. It. He just said that. I was just like, slam dunk. I get you. You are just, this is you. This is what you are. And you want to die here. And that's they're like, if we die, this is where I want to die. I don't want to die in Montreal. I don't want to die in Ottawa. I want to die in Beirut and full stop. Let's not argue. Let's not talk about this anymore. Mm. And I had to talk to my siblings and be like, just let it go. That's just what they want. Like, that's it. Like, it's yeah. not our decision.
You can't
it's
control
decision.
People or whatever, but it is odd as you get, I'm also in my, we're about the same age. You got 2 years on me, but you end mm-hmm. up weirdly, we're at an age where you start parenting your parents. Mm-hmm. And but you also recognize that they are more or less unparentable. So you know, like you, I have children, so I'm in this dual zone of like trying to help my kids and parent them, but then, you know, fielding calls from my parents and then trying to convince them that eating dinner at 8 p.m. is no longer a good look and healthy for them, you know? Like, you got to eat mm-hmm. at a normal... Yeah, my mother will just flat out say... My mother, I just got, as we're speaking, our belated Christmas package from my parents. And when we lived in Ontario, my mother would always buy... She thought she was doing the right thing. She'd buy like the cheapest like chocolates, like the what are the yeah. pot of gold or whatever. Not, I don't know if it's cheap, but you know that kind of schmaltzy box chocolate. And she'd be like, "Look, I got you this thing," and I'd be like, "Mom, trying to cut back on sugar. Sugar's not good for you." But she just did it every year. But she's
wait, can I guess what the box of chocolates was?
Sure, go ahead.
How like Britophiles are your parents?
Well, yeah, they did. That's Indian. A fair point. That's a fair point. They are they were or are in they India not? During colonization, and well, I shouldn't say that. They my dad was born in 1948, and colonization ended around that time. Yeah. So they were aware of it, but no, they didn't come up in it. I
was
guess.
It by any chance sense? A Macintosh Quality Street box?
No, I didn't. Haven't had that. No, they're not that. They were really into Peak Freens, those cookies. When
oh,
I
yeah,
was a
of
kid,
course
I think that's British. But I never really connected it to the colonization, but I feel like that's probably part of it. No, my point is, like, she sent me a box of sweets again. She sent yeah. us this box of sweets, and it was like, yeah. you know, Ferrero Rocher. She did send me some baklava, which I was actually very happy about, but uh-huh. it was just, like, unnecessary. Like, the postage involved in sending me a box of sweets, and when I called her to thank her, she said, "Oh, good, you're not angry at me. I thought you would be angry that I sent you sweets." I said it to my wife. She's like, "Why would she send you something if she knew it would make you angry? They're just the way they are, and you can't change them," is all I'm getting at. And that's, yeah. it sounds like you've realized that about your parents. You know,
yeah,
they're just
and,
the way
and,
they are.
Of course, and not that I don't want to change them. I never set out to, you know, change them. I have no care sure. for that. You know, I'm just, I respect them, and I feel like I would be, you know, I'm very attached. I'm very attached to my Lebanese identity, as you know, you can maybe tell from the work that I do artistically.
Yes.
And like with my children, I speak to them exclusively in Arabic since they were born. I do not speak to them in French, nor even though they're completely trilingual, they're fluent in all three languages, English, French, Arabic. And since they were born, I only speak to them in Arabic. And I tell them that I do not understand when they speak to me in French or English, even though French is, I would say, their strongest language at this point because of daycare. Mm. And English, because of their mother, is, you know, it's just extremely strong. And their Arabic is strong, but, you know, there's not that many Arabs in their life as much as I would like there to be. So for me, it's very important that, like, I parent them that way, that they understand that no matter what, they were born here, but they remain where you are born is not what your identity is what you decide your identity is. And I can only show you that this is one of the identities that you carry with you, whether you like it or not. It's for you to decide later, whether you want it or not. That's for you to decide later. But, you know, that they will have their Lebanese ID cards and that they will speak the language no matter what. You know, it's very important for me. It's very, very, very important for me because it was very important for my parents. And my parents, because we left Lebanon when we were born, like, it was very important for them that we maintain that part of our identity. And I see the positive part of that.
Yeah.
I see. And, you know, for me, I feel also all of our lives, because of these crazy places where we grew up, but, you know, there's a part of this that, like, sometimes my friends catch and are really, like, puzzled by it. For example, like, how I speak. I'm speaking to you now, I sound like a Canadian, right? Like you would never know if you, sure. you did not, if I did not say my name, I could be Michael something, you know? It's like, I do speak like a Canadian, but put me in a room with a bunch of Lebanese people and we all speak in English and all of a sudden our English changes. We speak, we will start speaking English like Lebanese people speak English. And same thing with French. And when I'm around Lebanese people, my French sounds very Parisian because that's the French we speak in Lebanon versus when I'm in a room full of Quebecois, my French has a bit more of a Quebecois, you know, twang to it because I'm in a room full of Quebecois. And that's just like, that's just how we grew up. We grew up that you sort of assimilate, not assimilate, but you sort of adapt to whatever's around you because you are never home. You're never in like your backyard. You're always in someone else's backyard. Therefore, you always have to be adapting quickly to what's around you. And I think it's fairly
noble of you to have instilled that within your children. I think it was probably informed by the fact that you moved to Canada when you were 15. So you were really deeply connected to your heritage for most of the formative part of your life, if you will. I'm saying this in somewhat of a self-defensive tone because I only occasionally speak Hindi to my children. Because I was born here and raised here and spent a good chunk of my childhood resisting some of my, it wasn't until I got to university that I really saw the value in my culture. And
Same here. I hear you. When we first moved here, the kids, myself and my siblings, were like, oh, we're Canadian now. That's it. What do Canadians do? Peanut butter. What the fuck is this disgusting shit? But like, we just have to eat it. These fucking idiots eat this. That's milk that's cold. Are you insane? That is disgusting. You know, like the food people ate. The food was the big one. The food was like, what the fuck are you eating? This is disgusting. Disgusting. And where's the bread? For fuck's sake, why is there no bread on the table?
Yeah, so you're trying to... But then, like, I grew to appreciate my... Even, you know, people... I'd live with a bunch of white people at university, and I'd go home to visit my parents for the weekend, and some of them would say, hey, is there any chance you could bring back some Indian food? And I'd be like, what? Do you like Indian food? Like, my whole life... I was resisting it. I'd be like, can't we just get fast food or can't we go out or I just want a sandwich. I want a peanut butter sandwich. I was the opposite of you. And they'd be like, no, we've made this beautiful Indian food and I didn't really value it until later. So it's just a thing where you, you know, you get kind of tunnel vision because you're kind of processing the fact that you live in this cultural clash every day where your parents act and speak in one way. But most of your day is spent at a school or outside playing road hockey or whatever with a bunch of people who don't talk that way. So you have this duality that you're negotiating. And I think this might be an okay segue to bring us back to your latest Jerusalem in My Heart record.
Oh, yeah, that's what we're talking about.
Whose title, I think, speaks to your concern, I suppose. Can you talk about the title and what that word means in Arabic?
Sure. The word qalaq means simply worry. But worry, depending on how it is used, it can, you know, sort of allude.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the ESL...
Allude. That's correct. Allude.
Yeah. Allude. Allude to like, you know, the degree of worry. And married, obviously, with the cover art, it just signals like this deep concern for where things are at, for whatever. Obviously, Lebanon. We're talking about Lebanon. We're talking about the world that I'm from, the place that I am from. And yeah, that's a deep, very unsettling worry about where we find ourselves in 2021.
Yeah, the cover image, for those who haven't seen it yet, and by the way, I've included it in the podcast description, or rather the link on my website anyway, but where you can also go to learn how to buy the record. But the cover art, I believe, is a photograph that was taken during the Beirut October Revolution from 2019. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. Taken by a absolutely stunning, wonderful photographer called Miriam Boulos.
Right. And it depicts, as I don't have it in front of me, it's behind me. I don't want to turn around. The record is on the floor behind me, leaning against a wall, but it's a fiery image. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's just taken during one of those protests that were happening almost daily in Beirut. of three women. We can tell immediately for a Lebanese, you look at that and you can tell immediately that they are not Beirutis. You can just tell how they are dressed, how they look. Many things that just kind of like clue you into that they are not really from the city or the city center, and that they are in this sort of like inferno of a fire where just everything around them is on fire, and they're just like, you can just, they're in a state of this insane, their own fire, their own explosion. It's a very, very powerful moment.
They look almost relatively calm. They look like nothing's happening, which tells you how normalized chaos might be for them. Is that fair?
Maybe. I mean, it's also a photo, right? So it can be just like a moment before someone's about to explode.
That's what I mean. I'm not saying that's how they felt. I just mean the photo seems to depict this normalcy to what is behind them is not anything anyone anywhere, almost anywhere else in the world would think is normal.
Yeah.
But there's almost a serenity in there. Like, yeah, that's just the way it is. That's where I pick up from the photograph, not necessarily the moment in history, but sorry, I'm just telling you, I'm doing a first year university reading of the photograph. I'm sorry. Is that okay?
Yeah. No. This work is, I always have this discussion with so many people about the work that I do because it's all in Arabic. I do not trend. I hate in the past. I've had to, and for many reasons. And now I've changed my position upon that. I don't like translating my lyrics. Yeah. I don't like needing to explain to people what I'm saying. Outside of conversations like this, where when it's a conversation, it's beautiful. But like the supposed that like I owe an English audience a fucking explanation of what I'm doing because you're entitled to a fucking English translation to everything that's in front of you. I've had so many concerts where people have come up and have been irritated at me because they couldn't understand what I was saying. And all you want to do is just like just brush these people and be like, just get out of my face. You're so stupid. It's like such a stupid thing to say. Yeah.
Well, I hate to do this to you, but I do. I appreciate what you're saying. But I do wonder how this umbrella term, kalak, deep worry, is sort of translated over the course of the record. Has 13 songs. There's a guest features, I suppose, on I believe every song. So can you, doing a translation, of course, can you talk about how the theme of deep concern and worry is sort of illuminated on the record with the in terms of its maybe it's the sound can be moody and jarring and all sorts of things, but then you also have these guests who in some cases are offering vocals, and I don't know if you had a hand in helping them compose such things. I'm thinking of Alanis Obomsawin, for example, who's very striking on the record. Anyway, sorry, can you talk a little bit about that? How did you translate the umbrella term and concept to these songs with all of these collaborators?
With each collaborator, the way I talk about how these collaborations came about on a technical level was that I kind of constructed a bit of a skeleton for the record, composed the skeleton, and gave a part of the skeleton to all these artists and told them to sort of add kind of flesh to it. So here's the skeleton. Do whatever you want. It is completely like carte blanche. You do whatever you want and you only get one pass. And whatever it is that you do, I will use. There's going to be no back and forth. There's going to be no talk about it. There's going to be no conversation. I want to capture whatever your understanding of what I'm sending you is. And there is no wrong. Whatever you do, I will use. Which was a fun challenge, I have to say. And it's putting a lot of pressure on the person who's doing the work, but also putting a lot of pressure on me to make whatever they give me work. And also, it's like, to me, a sign of deep respect to the person's ability, work, and understanding of what I'm doing. All these people are friends. There's a connection to all these people. It's not just like, you know, people who I like their music, therefore they're on here. They're all people who I have a personal connection to. And yeah, that was the process. So it was just person, like the title of the album was already... had already been established. The cover artwork came before anything. The title came before anything. All these ideas. The music was the very last thing, actually. So all this stuff, I gave all this like data to all these collaborators and told them, this is what this is about. This is what the record is about. This is where this comes from, and this is where this is going. what do you understand from that? And that's how people formed or created their contribution to the record.
I see.
And a perfect example would be Alanis. When she, what she decided to do was she sang a lullaby for my children. She talks about both Elham Lezama and Issa Sahar, my two kids. And she says their, she says their name. And she sang a lullaby for them because for her, that was, and that's what made the opening of that, the side B of the record, was that this like sort of, you talk about worry, well, the antidote to that is the power of the child, the power of the youth. And she said she sang a lullaby to them.
Right.
And I was like, that was a perfect interpretation of what I gave her versus Greg Fox's, you know, he took it and he took it 180 degrees the other way when he was just like, you know, this is my worry. This is what it is. And bam, he just like, you know,
yeah,
machine gun me down.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's the opening track. And it's, my wife will tell you it's a bit jarring to be in the kitchen and have that start plan. You know, that's all I'll say about that.
You'd be not a human if it wasn't jarring. It's not supposed to be pleasant. It's supposed to be jarring.
Absolutely.
It's supposed to be a clause coming at you. Like, that's the idea. It's like, that's like, look at the cover and that first bit of audio is what the soundtrack to that image is.
Yeah, and Jerusalem in my, I was going to say, Jerusalem in my heart as a musical entity is deeply connected, I believe, to film and imagery, particularly in a live setting. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, of course. The live component of the, I mean, this record, you know, there's a limited edition of this record that's about to sort of come out. We're just almost ready with the, there's a box set. There's a 50 edition box set of this record. We are just waiting on the actual, the thing that's stalling is the box that holds all the elements of the box set. That's what's delaying this whole release, which is driving me nuts at this point. But Ian has really designed an absolutely stunning box and given it to a box maker to make. And the box maker is running short on supplies to make the box. There is a version of the box of the record that exists, in a limited edition of that comes, that is accompanied by a film. So you buy the box set. It has the LP in its regular format, with a book, an accordion fold-out book that Alexei Perry Cox made that folds out into something that's about 5-6 meters long. Absolutely stunning book. And a canister of 60-millimeter film, like a positive print film that you can project. And on the optical soundtrack, there is an element of audio. It's the third track from side A. That track that's instrumental is missing the vocals. The vocals are not on the record. The vocals are on the film. So if you wanted to hear the vocals that are missing, they are on the film. And the idea behind this whole thing, I wanted to sort of create this like object that sort of would recreate this performative visual aspect of the show, which is far more important to me than the recorded aspect of the project, by synchronizing by, you know, your sort of freewheel synchronizing this LP. You have to put on the LP, you have to spool the film on a projector, take the audio out of the projector, put it through a speaker, and for you to listen and watch all three elements happen at the same time: optical audio on the film, image on the film, and audio from the LP. And that's where you would get the complete, that's to me the most accurate representation of Jerusalem in My Heart as a thing, as a fetishized object that you can take home. Because to me, the show is the most important thing in this project. Just you come to the performance with Aaron and I doing the filmic performance, which is this, yeah, about 100 loops that accompany the tracks, and that her and I have this like little dance that we do to present the show. So yeah, that was the closest thing I could do to do that. I'm only saying that because, yeah, to tell you that, yes, the performative aspect of it, the filmic aspect of it, is as important as the musical aspect of it. And unfortunately, on a record, you can't do that. Like, that's just, the format doesn't allow for that. So the record, I've always said that it's a compromise for me of what the project is.
I appreciate that. So if people want to learn more about this limited edition box set and most things to do with Jerusalem in My Heart, including tour dates, I assume they'd want to go to cstrecords.com. Is that fair?
Yes, that's the best place to go.
And then if they want to invest their resources into all the equipment necessary to enjoy the box set, they could go to Kijiji, eBay, these kinds of places. Is that fair?
That's fair. Or you can just rent them too.
You can rent them, from your local AV experimental filmmaking place, if you will.
Yes.
Probably.
Exactly. I don't make it easy. I know. It's just, I can't, you know, it's not intentionally hard. It's just, that's just That's maybe the material.
Does the box set come with a small projector that people can? Does it come with the equipment? Is that possible? Is there a way you could send that to each of the 50 recipients?
Just load in a 20 kilogram projector to people, put that in a box, and send it, and hope it gets
I'm making a little joke, but I do appreciate that you put so much effort into this. I appreciate your thoughtfulness generally, as you know. I hope, Radwan. Like it's great.
Thank you.
I think it's cool.
No,
so beyond, you mentioned potential March tour dates, 2022.
Yes.
Any other future? And then this box set, obviously, we just talked about. Is there anything else coming up for you beyond your work at the hotel at the Tango? But beyond the hotel, is there anything else going on that you want to talk about?
No. I mean, it's just 2022. There's like a boatload of collaborations that seem to be all lining up for the year. So I'm really, really looking forward to the year. I also am going to start working on this is going to sound funny, but I'm going to work on some solo music, even though Jerusalem Night is a solo project. Musically, I do want to start working towards a solo record that's under my name, not Jerusalem My Heart, sort of to break away from that, the confinements of the Jerusalem in My Heart and what it has become and what it is.
Do you already have an aesthetic vision for that? Like, if it would be not Jerusalem in My Heart, what would the distinction be?
I don't know. I do have a residency lined up to sit there and find an answer to that question. I mean, I have some ideas, of course, as always. There's no shortage of ideas, but I do.
Did you ever answer my question about your primary? You talked about someone teaching you how to play guitar.
Oh, guitar. I don't play guitar.
What is your primary instrument, if you have one?
My primary instrument is the studio, I have to say. I really... No, it is. Okay. The studio to me is an instrument. The instruments I play, I'll tell you what I play. I play the bouzouk, which is in Arabic we say bouzouk, but in English, bouzouk. And it's a lute. It's a Palestinian, Lebanese, Syrian lute, long neck lute that's a cousin to the oud. That's the principal instrument that I play. And I play a lot of electronics, and it's basically a little bit of and sing. So it's like all these three elements is what make the show and the records. When I say electronics, I know that's so vague, but yeah, a lot of modular, a lot of synthesis, a lot of computer clicking to create what I create. But yeah, I don't play any instrument very well. I feel like I just play the studio quite well, and that's the studio is what is the main instrument for me. And
you play the studio very well, so don't.
I
was just curious what. I'm prying into an unyet realized solo Radwan record. Like, what would that be? I'm just trying to picture it. You know what I mean?
I think it would be very much more vocal and bouzouk based.
Vocal in Arabic, though? Or would it be a different language, perhaps?
I cannot imagine me singing in English. My God. It would not even come out of my mouth. I don't know. That would be impossible.
Well, I just wonder what... that's all. You know what? Yeah. There's no point in speculating about... You don't even know yet. So I'm curious what direction it might take. As you say, it's... You made a joke. It didn't sound that funny to me that you would make a solo record outside of Jerusalem in My Heart. But in my mind, you performing as yourself would be some major departure from Jerusalem in My Heart. But I think it remains to be seen what that would be at this point. That's still fair to say, I think.
Yeah, I think we're probably 2 years away from that being a thing. But in the sense that if I start working on a record like now, today, it would be 2 years before that would be a thing. It's just just the way life works. But I do. I talked with my manager and we have set time aside and we are trying to find a residency program in France to sit, just lock myself up in a studio and work and try to come up with the first building blocks of a record and take it from there. See where that goes.
Okay, that's amazing. That sounds great. You're very busy, and I appreciate you making time for me. I mentioned CSTRecords.com, Constellation Records website. If people want to keep tabs on you specifically using various web platforms, where would you like to direct them, if anywhere?
I think Instagram is probably the most current thing. As I grow older, I really am trying to avoid social media more and more and more and more. I see the wisdom in that. Of course, I am a musician, which means you cannot do that. Otherwise, you know, your stuff doesn't work, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But yeah, Instagram, there's a Truth from My Heart and a personal Radwan Ghazi Mumne Instagram, where I try to keep between the two. Mostly, I don't post really personal stuff. It's mostly sort of artistic stuff.
Right.
So those I feel are good. I won't. There's no videos of me with a cat or anything.
Okay. We'll have to dig deep for that burner Instagram account you have, where it's just you and a cat hanging out.
Me and some random cat because I'm allergic to cats.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay. We'll try to find you
on that thing somehow.
Great.
Now,
and on Constellation's website and stuff like that. But other than that, no. I mean, come to a performance and try to engage and open your soul and see if if it catches anything. And if it doesn't, that's 100% great and cool.
Fair enough. Now, if we can go out in a song from Kalak, is it possible for you to pick one and also explain why you chose it?
I will pick... Oh, you are gonna... This is where it's gonna just shine how stupid I am. I don't know the numbers by heart of
the
side.
Oh, that's okay. If you cite the collaborator, I can tell you.
So, I mean, it's the context of it, because that whole record on... A track on its own feels a bit like destabilizing, but I would say the track with my very 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 dear friend Roger Tellier Craig, which I believe might be Kalak 2.
That's correct.
I think
that's correct.
Yes. Okay. Great. There we go. Not so bad. He's a very important friend. A most important. B an absolute inspiration. And C, just a goddamn fucking amazing artist that is just so underappreciated, I feel. And him working on this record with me was just a real, I was very happy and fortunate, even though we're so close and it was not even, he was like, yeah, sure, I'll do it. But to me personally, it just meant a lot that he did do this because he's so important to me and such a big influence on me, actually, in many, many, many ways.
Tell the folks at home what kind of music Roger plays or what outfits.
Yeah, Roger Tellier-Craig plays in Fly Panam, which to me is, for my personal taste, is the most important Montreal band within my in my microcosm. You know, a band that suffered from not the best production and the best translation of their ideas to tape. And I'm very lucky that I got to work with them for their last two records, which I'm very, 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 very proud of. Two records that I am some of the most proud records I've worked on, and like the hundreds and hundreds of records I've produced. So this is very important to me. He used to perform in Godspeed You Black Emperor, and he also had a duo with a visual artist. The duo was called Le Révélateur, and the other his partner in the project was an amazing mind-altering visual artist called Sabrina Raté, who lives in France now. And he performs solo as Roger Tellier-Craig. And I'm just a massive fan through and through. And him and I played in a band together. Shit, I almost forgot that. Fuck. We played in a band together. Oh my God, my brain. Well, this is like the least interesting of all the work, which is why I kind of don't even really put it. We played in a band together called Pachik Chic, where a couple of records were made. And yeah, he's just been there forever in my life. And forever he's been relevant. And for me, of all the people who have been around me as much as him, I am always blown away by how relevant he still is after all these years, where I feel like a lot of people in my community have gone, you know, their relevance has just wavers up and down, like all of us, like just human. And he is superhuman in that way of being very relevant. Unfortunately, not to the outside world, to me, but that's what's most important to me is me, because I love his work.
I appreciate that. And for what it's worth, Roger has been on this very program. 2019 to talk about the Fly Pan Am record C'est ça. And that's one you worked on, isn't it?
Yes, it is. That was the record that came back after their comeback, not comeback record, their reformed.
Yes, that's
record.
Right. Yeah. So all I'm telling you here is, Radwan, I appreciate your love of Roger, and I thank you for choosing this piece. It's a good call. So shall we play it for people now?
Please play it now. Is this where I get to say goodbye, or do I have to talk after the piece?
Well, I will say goodbye. We'll both say goodbye together. This is Kalak 2 featuring Roger Tellier-Craig from the beautiful and significant new record by Jerusalem in My Heart. Radwan, this was a tremendous pleasure. Thank you for making time for me and being on the show. It's nice to reconnect, and I wish you the best of luck in the future. And a happy new year to you as well.
Thank you so much. To you too and the family, thank you so much for giving me a moment to talk about these ideas. I really appreciate it and love the work you do. So thank you so much for including me in this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thanks again to Radwan for being on this show, which was what? What was it again? The 661st episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it and it's not available on whatever thing you use to follow podcasts because they've got a limited feed and they say 661 episodes, we're only going back to 300. You say, oh, well, what do I do? You can learn more about the show at my website, vishkana.com. That's also where you can go to sign up for my monthly newsletter, which I've neglected a little bit because I've been so busy. But I'll get it going again at some point. Again, sign up there and learn more about the show at vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on the Facebook or the Meta book. I don't know what it's called now. You can also follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter or Instagram or Metagram. I don't know what it's called, but the handle there at vishkana. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. $6 or more grants you access to exclusive content that I find either from my audio archives. You know, I have a long history of interviewing people, or sometimes and often, although not in this case, derived from current interviews. So what I'll do is I'll go a little OT with a guest and we'll talk about something. And then I put that part of the conversation up on the Patreon so that if you like somebody, you get a little bit more. Also, if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. Again, that address, patreon.com/creativecontrol. There's a link in the podcast description, I think, in almost any possible way you're accessing the show. There should be a link to our Patreon. Thanks again to the fine Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about at blackbird.ca. They are located in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, so if you're in the area, go there. Otherwise, visit their website, blackbyrd.ca. And also to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. As always, thanks to my good friend Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on this show. You can learn more about Jim and his really astounding catalog of song at his website, jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Radwan from Jerusalem in My Heart, and also the Hotel Tatango recording studio, which is a wonderful facility that I've had a chance to visit before, and I urge you to go check it out or book some time there when it feels safe to do so. I also want to thank you for subscribing to this podcast and telling your friends about it and spreading the word about it. It really means a lot for you to subscribe and follow the show and talk about it amongst yourselves. And otherwise, I got nothing else. I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.